Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 317 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And this is going to be a pediatric-themed podcast, but I'm going to call this Newborn Jaundice, Breastfeeding, and the MBME Exams. These are two topics that are very high yield, and for some bizarre reason, people just tend to screw up a lot on these topics. So I want to have a podcast where I really break it down and, you know, hopefully you find this to be helpful. And for those that are studying for Step 2, CK, Step 3, I have courses coming up in the month of June, aka this month, right? So like on the 17th of this month, I have the MBME Test Taking Strategies course. It's from 3 to 5:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And then I have the comprehensive 20-hour Step 2, CK, Step 3 course. It's going to be on the 18th and 19th. So on a Friday and a Saturday, it's going to be 10 hours each day. We're going to take two 2-hour breaks during the course of the day. And then at the end of the month, on the 20th of June, I have the MBME Test Taking Strategies course from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And then the 20-hour course as well, I have them from the 29th of June to the 2nd of July. It's going to be 5 hours each day from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. So if you're interested in any of those courses, just shoot me an email and I'll be more than happy to give you some more information while there's still spots left. Okay, so let's jump right into it. So let's maybe start with breastfeeding first. I think that's probably like a good starting point. So we know that breast milk, right, is something that usually comes in, and I'm going to be essentially talking about just multiple different vignettes, right, that the MBME can pose with breastfeeding. So the first thing I guess I want to talk about is how long are you supposed to breastfeed a child for, right? You want to exclusively breastfeed the child for at least 6 months on MBME exams, right? Obviously, longer than that is better, right? But you want to breastfeed a child for at least 6 months on an MBME exam, right? And one of the reasons that women don't breastfeed, I mean, the women don't make breast milk while they're pregnant, right, is because of progesterone. Progesterone suppresses prolactin's effect, right? So you're not able to get breast milk during, you know, during pregnancy, right? But the moment the child is born, the source of progestin is gone, aka the placenta. So now you can start making a ton of breast milk. So usually within like 2 to 5 days, the breast milk will come in. Now, on MBME exams, what if you get a question and they say, they give you some, you know, benign question about like a woman breastfeeding a child, and then they say, which of the following is an associated benefit of this practice or breastfeeding or whatever, right? So what are some things you get from breastfeeding a child? Well, it decreases your risk for certain high yield things. So one is like sudden infant death syndrome, SIDS. It actually does decrease your risk. And then many of these allergic diseases, right, like eczema, asthma, things of that nature, that risk is also decreased significantly by breastfeeding. And also, your immune system just works better as a child when you're breastfed by mom. Because again, remember, you're getting that IgA from mom's breast milk. And then in addition to that, your immune system is just built up. There are all these immune factors like lactoferrin and things like that that are all released from breast milk that, again, really help the baby. And then probably one of the highest yield things to know with the positive benefits of breastfeeding is that it actually decreases the risk of infections in the baby. Like really pretty much every infection, meningitis, otitis media, pneumonia, sinusitis, necrotizing enterocolitis, botulism, all those things, your risk is decreased precipitously if you breastfeed the child. And then also just the development of autoimmune disease later in life, right? You actually, or even in childhood, you actually decrease that risk as well by breastfeeding, right? So things like celiac disease, for example, you can significantly decrease the risk of celiac disease in a child by breastfeeding. So those are all positive benefits associated with breastfeeding on MBME exams. But the good thing about breastfeeding is it's not just good for baby, it's also great for mom. So what are some of the positive benefits you could see on MBME exams with regards to a mom that is breastfeeding? Well, we know that first things first, it's going to help with weight loss, right? Because again, you're giving up some calories in that manner. And by losing weight, right, you're reducing the risk of the woman having like, because remember, that peripartum period is a very dangerous period for getting stuff like MIs, PEs, DVTs. So you can minimize that risk by the weight loss that is provided through breastfeeding, right? So it actually lowers the risk of, because you see some women, after they deliver a child, right, you know, they're still really obese, which is no fault of theirs. They're still really obese. and then they go on to develop diabetes, right? So that risk of post-gestational diabetes mellitus is decreased by breastfeeding the child. And again, just cardiovascular disease in general, the risk is decreased by breastfeeding the child. And then remember, if you breastfeed a child for a long period of time, it's almost like you're exposing yourself to prolactin for a long period of time. I'll say that again. If you breastfeed a child for a long period of time, you're literally exposing yourself to prolactin for a long period of time. Well, we know what prolactin does. Prolactin suppresses the HPG axis, right? Prolactin directly inhibits the secretion of GnRH. So if you're making less GnRH, then you're making less FSH and LH. And then you are basically going to be ovulating less. And if you're ovulating less, the thing that's going to happen is, because remember, for a woman, every month, her ovaries literally explode. She secretes an egg, repairs that epithelium again. Next month, ovaries explode, secretes an egg, you repair that epithelial lining again. So if that epithelial lining is not destroyed all the time because you're ovulating less, because you have high levels of prolactin, which is suppressing your HPG axis, then you're actually going to decrease that person's risk of ovarian cancer. And then your breast cancer risk is also decreased the longer you breastfeed. Because again, if you think about it, just again, like I said, prolactin suppresses GnRH. And if you suppress GnRH, right, your FSH and LH is going to go down. Your estrogen and progesterone is going to go down. Because remember, there are certain breast cancers that are ER-PR positive, right? Certain breast cancers are ER-PR positive. So if you breastfeed, you're making less, because of the hyperprolactinemia you're getting, you have less estrogen and progesterone. So you have less of a driving force for breast cancer. And then it's also very high yield to know that when a person breastfeeds, right? Again, it just has many good benefits in general. If I'm not mistaken, I think I read a study back in the day that says that if a woman breastfeeds, she's literally like burning like 500 calories every day just from breastfeeding. Don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure I read that like maybe a few months or a few years, actually probably more so like a few years ago, right? So if you're burning 500 calories every day from breastfeeding, and then think about it, in 7 days, you're burning 3,500 calories. So that means in 7 days, you're burning a pound. You're literally losing a pound a week, right? You know, all other factors being, you know, I would imagine being health constant, right? So breastfeeding has lots of benefits. I know like in many developing countries, breastfeeding is like a big thing, right? It's done for sometimes up to 3 years old, right? Again, there's lots of benefits for that. But I know in the more advanced countries, you know, they do breastfeeding for like 6 months and then they're like, I'm done. Right. So again, I'd encourage you to kind of keep those things at the back of your mind as you're studying for NBME exams. Breastfeeding is a big high yield concept, and it's a kind of a simple concept, but there are just these little details that you kind of need to know on exams. And again, remember, breast milk, right, contains IgA, right? Breast milk contains IgA. That's a high yield thing to keep at the back of your mind. And the first breast milk you produce tends to have like higher IgA levels and higher immune marker levels than other breast milk you produce down the line. Right? That's something that's called colostrum, C-O-L-O-S-T-R-U-M. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that we have this woman that is 3 days postpartum and she has like unilateral breast tenderness and she has a temperature of 102 and she's like 30 something years old. If you see that, I hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this is mastitis, right? This is mastitis. Remember, mastitis, the most common cause of mastitis is Staph aureus on NBM exams. And we're going to treat it with dicloxacillin or oxacillin. Remember, those are those anti-staphylococcal penicillins. So use dicloxacillin or oxacillin. And you're going to tell the woman to keep breastfeeding so that she can clear the bug, right? You're not doing anything evil to baby by breastfeeding him, even if you have a mastitis. Now, what if they give you a question about a woman? So notice for mastitis, I said it's unilateral breast tenderness. So what if they give you a question about a woman that has unilateral breast tenderness? She's 2 days postpartum. She's 34 years old. And she has a temperature of 102. And then they tell you that you can palpate fluctuant mass in the breast, right? Again, this is unilateral. If you see this, I hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this is potentially some kind of breast abscess, right? Whenever you see that fluctuant mass, you see the fever and stuff. Again, unilateral process. I want you to think about a breast abscess. So how do we manage breast abscesses on NBM exams? We're going to manage it by performing an incision and drainage. Usually on NBM exams, you don't need to do any kind of antibiotic therapy for a breast abscess. And it's very high yield to know. They can say, oh, which of the following is the biggest, risk factor for a person having mastitis or a breast abscess? On NBM exams, the thing I want you to think about is, I want you to think of that person potentially having this think of the person potentially having the situation where, you know, because the newborn is trying to breastfeed, they cause these like micro breaks in the breast, right, or in the areola, and then through that you can then have bugs like staph aureus or like skin flora making its way into the breast tissue and causing those problems, right? So that's kind of like the risk factor, just again from these micro breaks in the skin, in the areola, things like that. Okay, now what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient has, you know, she's 4 days postpartum, she has bilateral breast tenderness. So notice this is not unilateral, this is bilateral. Bilateral breast tenderness, she has a temperature of 102, so she has a high fever, right? And again, she's a 33-year-old female, and you know, she's like 4 days postpartum. If you see this, I want you to think about breast engorgement. That's the thing, the fact that it's a, because I mean, I would hope that you're producing milk from like both breasts, right? So the fact that it's a bilateral process and there's fever should tell you that you're dealing more with breast engorgement, right? So again, remember, breast engorgement, bilateral process. Mastitis and a breast abscess, unilateral process. And then if a baby is exclusively being breastfed, right? What are some kinds of vitamins that should be, what should you try to supplement those kids with? Well, you want to make sure that those kids get vitamins K and vitamin D, right? In fact, the easy way to remember this, if you're a Brooklyn Nets fan, is Kevin Durant, KD, right? So vitamin K and vitamin D should be supplemented in kids that are exclusively being breastfed. I mean, before a baby leaves the hospital, they're going to get an iron shot of vitamin K. And then, you know, you want to make sure that you supplement vitamin D because those things are very low in breast milk. Now, what are some contraindications to breastfeeding on NBM exam? So what are some situations where you'd see and you'd be like, okay, sorry, we can't really breastfeed this child. Well, some of those high yield contraindications to keep in mind is if a mom is on chemotherapy, for example, if mom is on chemo, you absolutely, absolutely should not breastfeed that child on an NBM exam. Because again, remember, chemotherapy destroys rapidly dividing cells. So if you're given when a baby is literally like a big hub of rapidly dividing cells, right? So you don't want to give chemo to baby, right? So that will not, you know, that's probably not a smart idea. If a woman has active breast cancer, you also don't want to be breastfeeding the baby, right? And then if a woman is like abuses drugs, right? You also don't want to breastfeed the baby. If the woman has like active TB is an absolute contraindication to breastfeeding on NBM exams. Or if you have like active herpes lesions on the breast, in those circumstances, you also do not want to breastfeed the baby on an NBME exam, right? And then also having HIV. Remember the exam, for those of you that are listening to this podcast, you know, for the most part, it's thing to go taking the US MLE exams, right? So in general, right, like in the US, if a woman has HIV, she's not going to be breastfeeding that baby so that you don't transmit it to the fetus, right? And then galactosemia, right, is another very high yield one. Remember, galactosemia is a deficiency of an enzyme called galactose-1-phosphate uridyl transferase, right? So you're not able to take galactose down the pathway to all the way to glucose, right? You remember, usually these kids, they will have like positive reducing substances in their urine, and they will have like hepatosplenomegaly, and many times they can also have cataracts on an NBM exam. So again, very high yield to keep that at the back of your mind for tests. And then how do you, let's say, you know, I think one thing that the NBME like really likes to focus on these days is they'll give you like a select set of conditions and ask you what kind of baby formula should you give these kids. Well, so let's run through a few vignettes, right? So what if we see a child that has this galactosemia, right? This essential galactosemia I just talked about. Or let's say it's a child that, you know, has like lactose intolerance. What kind of formula do you want to give those kids? What kind of formula do you want to give those kids? Well, I hope you're saying, oh, Divine, I'm going to give that child baby formula that's rich in like soy protein, right? These soy protein formulas are actually pretty good in those circumstances. And then what if they give you a question about a child and they tell you that this child has like just tons and tons and tons of food allergies, right? And you need to put that child on formula, right? If you see something like this, especially if a child has like a cow milk allergy or a soy milk allergy, the key thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is you want to give that child formula that is rich in something called protein hydrolysate. It's very high yield to know that hydrolysate is spelled as H-Y-D-R-O-L-Y-S-A-T-E, right? So you want to give formula that is rich in protein hydrolysate. Now, what if they give you a question about a child and they tell you that, oh, this child is like a child that was born prematurely. This child has had like extensive bowel resection because the child's birth was complicated by necrotizing enterocolitis. What kind of formula would you want to give that child? I hope you're saying, oh, Divine, I'm going to give this child an amino acid based formula. right? You want to give that child an amino acid-based formula, right? Again, when a child has like short gut syndrome because you've cut out a ton of their bowel, those kids, they're going to have problems digesting proteins, right? So you want to give them like an amino acid-based formula, an amino acid-based formula. And then, you know, the best kind of formula to give a child, obviously breastfeeding is the best. But if for some reason you cannot breastfeed a child, then the thing you're going to do on an NBM exam in general is you want to, you know, use like a cow's milk based formula, right? You want to use like a cow's milk based formula just in general on NBMEs. And then what do you, should you give cow's milk to a, like a newborn on NBMEs? I hope you're saying, Divine, no, we're not going to do that, right? So remember, cow's milk in general is essentially contraindicated on NBM exams. I'm not saying cow's milk formula. I'm saying like just straight up cow's milk, right? It's contraindicated on NBM exams in kids that are less than a year old. Remember, that same rule also applies to like honey, right? So that you don't give those kids a botulism, right? So cow's milk, remember, cow's milk is very low in iron. Cow's milk is very low in fatty acids, right? So it's not necessarily the best thing for kids on exams. And then what if they give you a question about a child and they tell you that, oh, this child was born on a farm, right? Or lives in a rural area. And then this child, you know, has like this constant fatigue, is always sleepy, doesn't seem to participate much with, doesn't seem to be bonding with mom much, right? And then they give you labs and you notice that the child's MCV is like 110. And then you notice that the hemoglobin is low. If you see this, I would really hope you're telling me that, oh, Divine, this child has a folate deficiency, right? This child has a folate deficiency. So what's causing this child's folate deficiency? Well, the child's folate deficiency is being caused because the child is using goat milk, right? It's using goat's milk. Goat's milk is not the best milk, right? But again, they'll give you something about like, oh, they live on a farm and there's cows and goats on said farm, right? And they're feeding the child with a ton of goat's milk. Goat's milk is really low in folate, so it can cause a megaloblastic anemia. It can cause a megaloblastic anemia on NBM exams. So that's something you want to kind of keep at the back of your mind as you study for these, as you study for these tests. Goat's milk is also low in iron, right? So again, it's like a double whammy there. But the big thing you want to keep in mind with goat's milk on NBM exams is that it's low in folate. So it can cause a megaloblastic, it can cause a megaloblastic anemia, right? It can cause a megaloblastic anemia. And then some other things I guess I want to say, right? So what if they give you a question about a child, right, that has, you know, jaundice. So this is me still talking about breastfeeding, right? So they talk about this child, and this child, you know, they tell you that this child feeds like once every, is a newborn, literally like a neonate, feeds like, and this is like 2-3 days after birth, has like generalized yellowing of his skin. And then they tell you that this newborn latches on and takes breast milk like every 4 to 6 hours or something like that, and only takes a small amount. And then they're trying to get you to make the diagnosis. And let's say they give you like a bilirubin, and you notice that the total bilirubin is like 4 or 5. And then the direct fraction of it is 0.5, right? So this child has an indirect hyperbilirubinemia, and you're noticing is at less than 7 days of life. And then you also notice that this child is not being breastfed often, right? As a newborn, you're supposed to be getting breast milk like roughly every 2 hours. If you're getting like 4 to 6 hours and you're getting a small amount each time, if you see this cluster of symptoms I just described, I really want you to think about breastfeeding jaundice. I want you to think about breastfeeding jaundice, right? So one thing about breastfeeding jaundice, remember the F in breastfeeding for the F in the first week of life, right? So what's the pathophys behind that breastfeeding jaundice? Essentially, the thing that happens is the baby is not getting adequate amounts of breast milk, right? So because the baby is not getting adequate amounts of breast milk, the child is pretty much dehydrated. And when you're dehydrated, that actually increases your GI transit time. So if you increase your GI transit time, you're going to have a lot of this process called enterohepatic recirculation. Basically, enterohepatic recirculation is just something that happens where the bilirubin that you put in your GI tract, instead of pooping it out, you know, as like converting it first to stercobilinogen and then to stercobilin and then pooping it out, right? You reabsorb more of it back into the circulation. So because the GI transit time is increased in a child that is dehydrated, you're going to have more enterohepatic recirculation. You're going to reabsorb more bilirubin. And remember, kids, they are not very good at handling bilirubin, right? Because they have very low levels of UDP glucuronosyl transferase. I mean, like as a newborn, your UDP GT activity levels is like 0.1 to like 1% of like adult activity levels. So in those circumstances, right, this child will be getting more bilirubin than they can handle. And remember, kids, maybe let me backtrack a little bit here. Maybe like, Divine, why will kids have a ton of bilirubin to even start with? Well, remember, as a child in utero, you're pretty much not using your lungs, right? Your lungs are literally like a bag of fluid. So because you're not using your lungs, being in utero is a state of relative hypoxia. So that state of relative hypoxia tells those cells in the kidneys, your peritubular cells in the kidneys, and they make a ton of EPO, ton of erythropoietin. If you make a ton of erythropoietin, well, surprise, surprise, the thing that's going to happen is you're going to have a very high hemoglobin, very high hematocrit. So kids, after they are born, they're like, okay, my lungs work now, so let's maybe go ahead and dump down on this hemoglobin load that we have, right? So as new, in the first few weeks of life, there's a lot of destruction of red blood cells. Well, remember, as red blood cells are destroyed, that heme, right, you know, is converted by biliverdin reductase to, by heme oxygenase first to biliverdin, and then biliverdin reductase converts that biliverdin to indirect bilirubin, right? So kids, they're producing a ton of indirect bilirubin, but then the enzyme to metabolize that indirect bilirubin to direct bilirubin does not exist, right? Or at least does not exist in adult quantities. So that's why kids are predisposed to having jaundice, right? So that's why, essentially, if a child is dehydrated because the child is not being breastfed regularly, again, you're going to have increased enterohepatic recirculation. And if that happens, right, again, the baby is going to have jaundice, right? This is what's called breastfeeding jaundice. And again, your treatment basically is just to make sure that the child is being fed adequately. And then what if they give you a presentation like, let's say, like second week of life going forward, right? Usually it's going to be within like 8 to 14 days on an NBM exam, although, you know, they can make it 6 to 14 days, you know, just to blur the lines a little to mess with your head. But if they give you a question about a child, and this child, you know, they tell you that this child physical exam is completely normal, this child is gaining weight appropriately and everything, right? But you notice that this child has jaundice, right? Then I really want you to think about like something called breast milk jaundice, right? So the thing is, the exact pathophysiology behind breast milk jaundice, no one really knows, but it's going to be like a really, really, really mild jaundice. And basically, people think that the pathophys involves a child having something like some stuff in the breast milk that the child is consuming, inhibiting UDP glucuronosyl transferase. So if you inhibit UDP GT, obviously you're not going to be able to convert indirect bilirubin to direct bilirubin. But for the most part, the child is going to be fine. To be honest with you, they almost never on NBM exams test breast milk jaundice. I just decided to include it here for completeness sake. So I'll encourage you, in general, breast milk jaundice is very rarely the right answer ever on NBM exams, because the presentation is very non-specific. But breastfeeding jaundice, the presentation is pretty specific, right? The presentation is pretty specific. And then one thing I want to mention is, hopefully you know what qualifies as physiologic jaundice, right? Or maybe let's talk about what qualifies as pathologic jaundice. Whenever a child has direct hyperbilirubinemia, literally for any reason, that's always going to be pathologic, right? Physiologic jaundice is indirect, right? So if you see a child and this child has direct hyperbilirubinemia, then I want you to think of pathological jaundice, right? And remember, the most common causes of pathological jaundice, right, on NBM exams, the first one you want to think about is biliary atresia, and then a second one you want to think about is a choledochal cyst. But if you see both, pick biliary atresia. Remember, biliary atresia, you need to fix it as quickly as possible after birth, right, within like the first 2 to 4 weeks of birth, right? Earlier is better with the Kasai procedure, right? If not, the child is going to need a liver transplant. And then if you also have jaundice within the first 24 hours of life, that's also always pathological, right? A child should never develop jaundice within the first 24 hours of life. If they do, then that's an example of pathological jaundice on NBM exams. Now, if a child has like really bad jaundice, what are you usually going to do? Well, you're usually going to use phototherapy, right, for these kids. And what exactly does phototherapy do? Because sometimes, instead of asking you about like phototherapy, they can ask you about the mechanism behind phototherapy actually helping. Well, the reason that phototherapy works is that it basically converts transbilirubin, which is water insoluble, to cisbilirubin, which is water soluble, right? So that's why phototherapy with those billy lights are really helpful. Usually when you're doing phototherapy, you want to make sure you cover the child's eyes, because again, you don't want that light damaging the child's eye, overwhelming the child's visual apparatus. And then there are some situations where you want to go ahead and proceed to partial exchange transfusion on an NBM exam. Well, the situations where you're going to do that are things like, if for example you've tried phototherapy with billy lights and it's not working, right? If phototherapy with billy lights is not working, then you notice that, wow, okay, this child's bilirubin is still rising despite the use of phototherapy, then that's an indication for partial exchange transfusion. And then also, if a child has a total bilirubin that is more than 25, that's also an indication for partial exchange transfusion. The reason you want to get aggressive with treating jaundice in kids is that it can cause chronic tears, right? So usually it will be a question where, like, a few weeks after birth or a few months after birth, the child is somnolent, the child is always lethargic, doesn't seem to be developing appropriately, has hearing problems, right? Because essentially that indirect bilirubin has crossed the blood-brain barrier and it has deposited in the basal ganglia, and then it has essentially damaged the child's brain, right? So that's why you kind of treat that, you don't treat that with levity, right? It's something you don't treat with levity. And then one thing I guess I forgot to mention is, what if you see like a microcytic anemia in an 8-month-old child that is getting cow's milk in his diet? Well, if you see that, you want to think about iron deficiency anemia, right? Cow's milk, again, I didn't say cow's milk based formula, I said cow's milk has a very strong association on NBMEs with a child developing iron deficiency anemia. It's one of these rare things you want to keep at the back of your mind for NBME exams. Something, again, definitely want to keep in mind for NBME exams. So I think I've pretty much discussed everything I want to say from this breastfeeding and jaundice perspective. And remember, you don't do phototherapy for direct hyperbilirubinemia. I want to establish that again. You do not do phototherapy for direct hyperbilirubinemia in a newborn on NBME exams. It doesn't work. It only works for indirect hyperbilirubinemia. So again, as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer these, again, comprehensive courses for step 2 CK and step 3. And I also help with applications like ERAS applications, personal statements, and things of that nature. Again, I've worked with people for years, people with red flags, tricky applications, and things like that. And there are many successful residents now in residency that I've definitely worked with in very, you know, in the less competitive and also in the more competitive specialties. So if that's something you're interested in, again, just shoot me an email through the website and I'll be happy to give you some more information. And again, I also have these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, and on Spotify. So please subscribe to those. At least the most recent 150 podcasts will be on there. If you want everything from episode 1, go to the website. It's a WordPress rule. There's really nothing I can do to circumvent it. And then one other thing I would like to say is I do have a YouTube channel. It's called Divine Intervention, USMLE Podcasts and Videos. And basically, that's where I put all my videos. That's where I essentially put all my videos. If you go there, you'll see like my internal medicine videos, my surgery videos, and all those things. Although the slides that go along with those videos are classically on the website. Again, go on the website and you'll find those. And then again, if you want to get an email notification whenever I make a new podcast, just go to the website, divineinterventionpodcast.com, podcast with an S.com, and subscribe. Once you subscribe, you'll get an email notification whenever I make a new podcast. So thank you for listening. I just want to share a quick life lesson today. And my life lesson today is on the importance of being discreet. I know I've kind of alluded to this in some other prior podcasts, but this is something that people don't think about much. I don't know, I feel like we live in this social media generation where everything about a person's life, they put it online. If they meet a new person, a new relationship person, they put it online. Basically, you can deduce some many facts about some people's lives just by looking at their social media page, right? If they've just recently gone through a breakup, you're gonna know online, right? You're just gonna be able to tell. If they celebrate their birthday, you're gonna be able to tell. If they do this, again, I'm not saying you shouldn't celebrate your accomplishments, but the thing is, there's a lot of jealousy in this world. If you don't know, there is definitely a lot of jealousy in this world. Right. So I just feel like there are certain details of your life that doesn't have to be put in the public eye, that doesn't have to be thrown on social media. Right. Because many times you see like, oh, let's say a person is running for public office. Right. And you see immediately the competing candidate is like, what's my next best step in management? Let me go and find some dirt that I can dig up on this person. Right. But the thing is, this is especially important for people that are involved in medicine. Because as a medical professional or as a person that is applying to residency in the future, right, whether you like it or not, other residents that may be interviewing you, let's say they say, oh, you know, a resident is going to be part of our admissions committee or the program director or the members of the residency selection committee. One thing they routinely do is to just check a person's social media presence, right? So if, for example, they see a picture of you on social media or a video of you on social media, like you're at the beach, you're popping a ton of alcohol or you're smoking marijuana or whatever, that's usually not wise, right? That can be like the sole reason why they take your application and throw it in the trash, right? So that's one thing I think I will encourage you to keep in mind. Just be discreet, right? Be discreet. That is one thing. I mean, maybe my background being a Nigerian has taught me like loud and clear. But I've seen many people's lives destroyed just because they were not discreet, right? I mean, like, if you even look at the, if you even look at the Bible, right? You know, if, you know, for those people that, you know, study the Bible a lot, you'll see that there's a part of the Bible where some people came from Babylon to visit Hezekiah. And Hezekiah was one of the kings of Israel back in the day. He showed them all his treasures, showed them the temple of God, showed them everything. But God chastised him for that. And it was not too long after that, that those same people that he showed off all those things to, they came and essentially took the Israelites into captivity, right? So it's just something to kind of be mindful of, right? Like if he was discreet, maybe that would not have happened, right? God was not very pleased with him, right? So I'm just encouraging you, because when you're applying with this ERAS process, like again, people look, oh, what is this person about? What does this person do for a living? How is this person's behavior? What kind of friends does, what kind of company does this person keep, right? How does this person spend their leisure? Is this person like very loud and very obtrusive on social media, right? Are they people of like that are super opinionated, very strong opinions? Again, those kinds of things come off the wrong way to residency programs. So I'll just encourage you to be really, 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 really careful. And then another thing I should also speak to is just being wise with drug use, right? Again, don't get me wrong. Like, I'm not going to start talking about drug abuse or whatever, but I'll just say this because this pops up, you know, you see a thread on Reddit or an SDN every now and then about a person that just matched into residency and then they need to do a urine drug screen and then it's positive for marijuana. I will encourage you, again, if you're a person that uses weed and you want to go into the healthcare system, be wise. Be wise, right? I'll encourage you because, again, it can be little things like that that can completely destroy a person's future, right? It's the kind of thing that, oh, they see it and then they're like, oh, sorry, we're going to go ahead and rescind this residency spot that we're giving to you. May sound unfair, probably, right? But again, they have every right. Again, the thing is, residency is a seller's market, right? Like residency applications are a seller's market. Like if they notice that you are not very serious with the process, there is a couple hundred more people that will be willing to take that spot that you just pissed away, right? So again, just be wise, right? Because if there's something you've worked for so hard in your life, why would you use like the fact that, oh, you're using marijuana to completely throw that away, right? Because think of it, for example, you've probably spent 4 years in undergrad studying extremely hard to get like perfect scores and crush the MCAT. Some people even take a year off to study for the MCAT, do research, all this shadowing and stuff you did. And then going into med school, you studied for a long time to do well on step one, on step two CK, do well on your preclinical exams, do well on your shelf exams. You had to go into the hospital all the time. Why would you want to piss that away because of something small that you could potentially live without for? Just be wise. I'll just say just be wise, because the thing is, there are just many unfortunate decisions that people in medicine take, and then it just completely like short circuits their future. Like, and that thing that some people do that kind of kills their future is, you see people, they're studying for any of the USMLE exams. Again, sorry, I'm kind of going on a soapbox here, but I kind of feel like these things are kind of important, right? You see people, they know that they've taken like one or two practice exams and they are barely passing their practice exams. But then they take this hope and prayer that, you know what, I'm gonna trust that I'm gonna do really well on test day. Like they magically like, oh, let's say they're studying for step two CK and they've been getting like 205s on their practice tests or 212s. They're like barely passing practice tests. And then they miraculously believe that they'll get a 240 on exam day. Well, guess what? You're putting yourself in a very tough spot. You're literally putting yourself in a very tough spot, right? So again, don't hope for these kinds of miracles, right? Don't hope for these kinds of, again, I'm not saying I definitely believe in miracles. You know, I'm a Christian, right? And miracles definitely do happen, right? But again, like, if you know you're not doing well on your practice exams, you need to go back and check your study process, right? You need to go back and check your study process. Where are you missing it? Where are you doing things wrong? So hopefully you found this podcast to be helpful. Again, it's a pretty high yield podcast. So I'll see you in the next episode. Thank you. God bless you.